Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com.
Hey, everyone. It's Dave Asprey with Bulletproof Radio. Today's cool fact of the day is that when a story is told, both the storyteller and the listener's brains are active in the same areas. It's called neural coupling, and what it means is that your two brains are in sync with each other so that when you're telling a story, you're actually putting thoughts, ideas, and emotions into your listener's brains. And this is why storytelling is an important part of getting whatever it is you'd like done. When you can tell a story, you can get the idea across in a way that you might not with just words.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat Cold Tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's episode is going to be obviously about telling stories, if I didn't sort of give you a hint with that cool fact of the day. But before we get into it, there's a couple things that I want to share with you. Number one, I'm wearing my cool new Erlen filters. If you've heard the episode with Helen Erlen talking about how different light affects your brain, these are some new shades, an update to my orange ones. Because my brain has actually changed, it's getting healthier, and this is a color that actually looks a little bit cooler than orange anyway, but I'll wear these sometimes, sometimes not. I'm right now just experimenting with them. And Moldy has now been seen by 60,000 people, so if you haven't seen Moldy Movie, go over to moldymovie.com, check it out, and while you're at it, check out bulletproofconference.com, because it is now discounted for you to get there for the October conference. It's going to be amazing. Today's guest is someone who was introduced to us through the Bulletproof forums, and that's a great place for you to go and suggest guests for the show. And it's Robert McKee. Robert's a Fulbright scholar and one of the most sought-after screenwriting lecturers around the globe. He runs the McKee Story Seminars, and for 25 years, he's been the guy you go to when you want to learn about writing and storytelling. He's taught more than 100,000 screenwriters, novelists, and playwrights, including a few guys you might have heard of like Peter Jackson, Russell Brand, Jimmy Fallon, Julia Roberts, Kirk Douglas, David Bowie, and a whole bunch more. So basically, famous guy has been performing at the very top of his game for many, many years. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Oh, thank you, Dave.
It's an honor to have you here.
My pleasure.
You wrote, or you created a seminar called Storynomics, which is probably the most renowned. And you talk about how people use story in that. Can you give our listeners an understanding of why you focus so heavily on story in that seminar particularly?
Well, it's a seminar, of course, as the title suggests, for business. And for, storynomics means, the connection between story and money. What happened essentially is that over the years, a number of people who had no ambitions to write fiction or make documentaries or anything like that, simply business people, were coming to my lectures to try to learn the elements of story and how to compose a story as techniques for both marketing, talking outward into the world, and inward in leadership, in strategizing, team building, and so forth. So I was caught up in this, and I talked to these people, and I realized that there's a real need in the business community for some clear thinking on the nature of story and the use of story in both directions, inward and outward, from and into the company. And so I put together Storynomics as a way to introduce people in business to the nature of story and the effective use of story in all of those directions.
What has the biggest impact been when you've seen an organization, or just say an entrepreneur, a CEO or a chief marketing officer, someone like that, who isn't good at storytelling, who comes to one of your seminars and learns the power of story? Like, what shifts would they see in how they communicate?
Well, what shifts, of course, is their when they use it and use it well. Of course, it's not just a matter of using any old story, but the story that they tell has to be well told and effective. But when they master it and learn to tell a story well, the success of the company escalates. I mean, what the net result is that they have a greater income, their business expands. I mean, one of my clients is a construction company, a major construction company called Bolt Construction. They build power plants and hospitals and educational institutions of all kinds. They used to bid in order to, get their work. They have to win a bid competitively. And they used to bid in the old-fashioned way of pitting their numbers against the competitors' numbers in a rhetorical point, therefore higher bid. I taught them how to storyfy their bids, how to tell the story from the client's point of view, making the client the core character in the story, and use the same data. I mean, the numbers don't change, but the vehicle for conveying those numbers and the process of the bid and the dynamics of the bid to the client changed greatly. And as a result, they went from winning one bid out of 10 to winning one bid out of 2.
Wow.
They doubled their gross. They jumped 20 places up the 100 top construction companies in America by simply learning how to take data and storyfy it. And as you were saying in your introduction, when you do that, the people making the bid, the people listening to the bid are in sync. That's the result, is that communication becomes enormously more effective.
So if you're just getting started in your career, let's say, early 20s, just finished school, and you're going in for a job interview.
Yeah.
If you can tell a story, it sounds like you have a much better chance of getting the job, right?
You do, but that's a tricky terrain. You have to know what kind of story to tell. In those situations, I would not advise somebody to go into an interview and start telling the interviewer the story of their life.
Yeah, that's bad.
That's bad news. And they have to learn this in marketing as well. The thing that turns people off more than anything else is bragging.
Yes.
Bragging and promising. I'm the best. I'm this, I'm that. Bragging, and I will do this for your company, and I will do that. Bragging and promising really turns people off. The best story to tell, I would think, in the context of an interview, is about someone else, maybe a teacher who really inspired you. I think you should avoid your parents. Somebody else other than yourself, something about the nature, a story that would link you to the nature of the company and the kind of work you're being interviewed for, but is not on the nose about you. So you get the same thing across, which is your enthusiasm, your knowledge of the job, your preparation for the job, your passion about doing this kind of work. All of that can get across, but in a story that stars the person that's interviewing you, that stars the company that you're going to go work for. I mean, if you told a really effective story demonstrating that you've done your research and you know this company inside and out, you know what they do, and you want to be a part of that enterprise, tell the story about the company that you're trying to be hired by. Any of those ploys would be much more effective than simply saying, you know, telling your life story. But once you get that, putting it in story form rather than a list of facts, when that company was established, how much money that company makes, how many clients they have, etc. Just reciting a list of facts about the company is not a story. And so you'd have to take what you know, your knowledge, convert it to a story starring someone other than yourself that implies who you are and why they should hire you. If you can manage a strategy like that, interviews would go very, very well.
One of the favorite questions that I like to ask people during an interview is, tell me about a time you failed. Because I'm actually totally okay with people who fail at things. Usually, if you haven't failed, then you're going to be really afraid of it, and you won't push your limits because you're so concerned about it. How would you go about that kind of situation where someone asks you to tell kind of a negative story, but one that might have a gold lining? Is there a way to do that in a way that's advantageous?
Well, off the top of your head, that story, if they didn't see that question coming, that's very dangerous. Very dangerous. The story that you would tell there would have to start yourself, wouldn't it? The risk is that the people, of course, would get dishonest about that.
Yeah.
They make one up. And however they failed in whatever story they told, it wouldn't be their fault. So, that's a wonderful question. The only advice I could give to somebody on the receiving end of that question is tell the truth, and the climax of the story would have to be a positive one, even though it's about failure, and that the climax would be what I learned by failure.
Yes.
Let's take an exceptional person to improvise that story if they didn't know the question was coming.
I think it's because I like to hire exceptional people. Yeah. Shout out to all the Bulletproof team. And it's a tough one because if you're afraid of failure, oftentimes that fear can interrupt your ability to tell a good story. And it may trip you up and make you a little bit more honest. But I guess I gave away my secret because now everyone who hears this will know I might ask that during an interview. But that's okay too.
Well, people in business generally, of course, are risk averse.
Yeah.
And one of the difficulties they have in using story to communicate is that story has to have a negative component. If it's going to have a positive ending, it has to, at some point, hit a negative base.
Yeah.
It has to be a problem and its solution. But you have to be able to dramatize that problem, dramatize the need or whatever, what's gone wrong or needs a solution. And so that is often difficult for people in business because they just don't want to be associated with anything negative. And one of the problems I have working, but I can get past this, but when working with a client, I've got to get them over there what I call megaphobia, which is rampant everywhere in business, the fear of all things negative, of saying, in fact, I was told about a book, I haven't read it, but a book on business in which the writer advised people that when they're in meetings, they should never use the word but. But is too negative. You know, we tried to do this, but it didn't work. We went in this direction, but we should have gone another direction. Whatever. The word but, he claimed, is too negative. And so therefore, he recommended using the word however.
Oh, come on. It's the same word, but more highfalutin.
Of course it is. Of course it is. But however, he felt, was just was easier on the ears and less somehow negative. I mean, that is how hypersensitive people in business are to anything negative, anything that suggests failure, anything that suggests even risk. And if they can't get over that, I mean, if they can't bring themselves to grapple with reality, and you know, half of reality is negative, their stories have no energy. Their stories just become some kind of bragging and promising. Or some kind of emotional manipulation, using pretty pictures to seduce, or if it's a political campaign, using negative pictures to damn the opponent, but some kind of emotional manipulation. And so getting people in business to really embrace the power of story, one of the great tasks I have is to get them to deal in reality and recognize that every well-told story is going to have a negative dimension to it, in order that the positive ending of the story have impact. Because if it's positive, 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 it's meaningless.
It lacks credibility, right? And you can't have light without darkness.
Exactly. We know that. And, you know, and people in business know that, you know, it isn't all sunshine and strawberries. And so they don't believe it. When they hear somebody reciting positive, 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 they sit there skeptical, cynical, not buying it. But as I said, to get business people over that threshold, I have to, show them many great examples, of course, of storytelling that has that negative dimension, and that is why it has such power.
What is the single best example of storytelling that you know of?
Oh, every day somebody's somewhere comes up with a whole new wonderful marketing campaign or speech and leadership tactic that knocks me out. Right now, I happen to be in love with the Adobe company.
Okay.
Adobe is putting out, and I don't know the ad agency that they hired to do this, but it could have been done in-house. I just don't know. But Adobe, their market is marketers.
Yeah.
Adobe has marketing software, marketing servicing, and so they've got to sell this to marketers. I mean, if I could create a special place in hell, that would be it, that your job is to market to marketers, right?
Yeah.
And they've got a series that they put out that star marketers that is so effective. The storytelling is just brilliant. And what they've done is they've really sat down and asked themselves what it is to be a marketer. Day in, day out, the CMO has got people coming in pitching this software, this system, this or that, and they've making promises. You know, this is going to. I've seen an ad campaign marketing campaign done for Coca-Cola that promised it would double Coke sales. I mean, all the absurdities, but nonetheless.
Wow.
Promises like that, and so. When marketers are sitting there fielding these pitches from these companies like Adobe, the first problem they have, of course, is bullshit. Most of what they're hearing is bullshit.
Yeah.
The second problem is that when they use this technology, the data is erroneous. They get a lot of false data. They're promising data that will really let them make decisions based in reality, but the data itself is flawed. And so Adobe's got these wonderful pieces out where they show marketers dealing with fielding the bullshit from software salesmen, dealing with false and inaccurate data. And these stories just knock me out. They're done with wit. They're done with a certain wonderful kind of cynicism. And yet, you just know that they're terrifically effective. I mean, Adobe's doing very, very well against its competition. And so Adobe understands marketers and tells stories that star marketers. And as a result, the people that they're pitching to are moved to adopt Adobe's technology.
Let's say that you're not running Adobe's marketing, but you're, let's say, in the Parent Teacher Association, PTA.
Yeah.
How can you take these storytelling skills and sort of just use them in daily life to be more effective rather than sort of at the boardroom level? I think a lot of people listening don't know how to bring those skills to use on a daily basis. Well, how do you advise people to do that?
Well, you to tell an effective business story, mm-hmm. right? Now, this is not fiction. I mean,
true stories, right?
Fiction. These are business stories. This is what I call the purpose told story. The purpose told story is not entertainment. I mean, if it's well told, it will be entertaining, like those Adobe pieces I mentioned, but it's not entertainment. It's told to hook attention, hold attention, and then pay off that attention with a story climax that moves the listener to action. The purpose is to get people to do what you need them to do, to take action, to buy a product, to agree with a policy and execute the policy, whatever it is. So if I was on a school board, and I need votes on that board and to take an action I want that I think will be effective for the school. The first step is to identify the audience. I mean, stories are actually written backwards, not forwards. You start with the ending, and the purpose told story in business especially. Who am I talking to? And identify that audience very specifically. And then the next question is, and where does it hurt for that person? What does that person need? What does that person want? What is their problem? Where does it hurt? What are they suffering from? And identify their need, their where it hurts. Then you have to ask yourself, and what do I want this person to do? to vote my way or whatever, okay? And so when you understand who you're talking to and what their problem is in life that your story is going to solve, and after they've heard your story, how you want them to then act, getting all of that together, right, is the first step. Then you go back and you would make the person you're talking to the core character of the story. You would tell a story about them, a story that says, I'm on your side. I know where you hurt. I've been there. I've seen it. I get it. And here's how you, by voting this way, can take a step towards solving your problem and making what hurts go away. And so that's, you know, that's a simple process, but it's simple to talk about, it's not easy to do, but it starts with the ending. Who am I talking to? Where does it hurt? What do I want them to do? Then you go back and you compose a story designed to dramatize your understanding of their problem and starring them. Not you, them. I mean, this is one of the most important steps for any business to take is to understand that today they must become consumer-centric. The stories that they tell have to be about the consumer, and they have to star the consumer and dramatize an awareness of the consumer's needs in life, and that your company or your whoever are on the consumer side. And so if I were on the board of a school and I'm talking to parents, that's a different audience. It's a different kind of hurt and a different kind of need. And so I would tell the story about the parents and their struggle to get a first-rate education for their children, and all that, like that. And so that, you know, you start with the ending.
Start with the ending. All right. And I found that the ability to communicate really complex ideas in a story helped enormously. For a while, I ran the Web and Internet Engineering program for the University of California. And there I'm trying to tell a story about, you know, this packet that needs to go from one end of the internet to the other. And it traverses all these different terrains. But it was such a complex thing. The only way I could figure out to convey this over 5 years of testing it was to sort of tell a story about, all right, like you personalize this little bit of information and all the places it goes. I wish that I had known that early in my teaching career, because it was, the facts didn't work, even with engineers. But the picture, the story that went along with it, and that helped to form even the way that we're talking today, just kind of beating myself against a wall of really complex ideas. That was a painful lesson for me. When you're talking with some of your clients, like Microsoft and these really big companies, how do you short circuit that long learning process to make someone good at telling a story, or at least passable, so that they can get these ideas across?
I workshop.
Okay. And the workshops that you do, how long are they?
Depends. At least a day or two.
Okay.
Depends. It depends on how many people do they want me to work face-to-face with. The workshop, you know, consists of the executive comes in with what they think is a story. And I don't give them any, you know, I don't give them any lecture. Perhaps they've come to my Storynomics before. But they get up and they pitch. They tell their story. Then I take it apart, and I show them what worked and what didn't, and how they could fix it. And then they go off for whatever time, and they rewrite or rework that story, and they come back and they do it a second time to see if they can, you know, take this direction and rework the story in an effective way. And then we take notes again, and you know, we have an audience of other executives, people at the company who are, you know, working on these problems as well, and they give notes, but it's primarily my notes, and so they do it at least twice, and then if it's the second day, they come back again, third time, and they see the progress. I mean, I can explain to people what a story is. I can show them multitude examples in various contexts of people using story, not just to market, but in leadership. And that takes them to a certain point of understanding. But still, they need to practice. I mean, they need to do it, to take notes, and to be shown, because I'm a good storyteller. And so I can take almost anybody's story that they pitch to the company and or to hypothetical clients. And I can rework that story on the spot. And the moment I do, they immediately say, oh, yeah, that would be better, that would be better. Because they're making all the amateur mistakes. So they learn from that. So workshops is the bridge that takes them from understanding from the lecture, getting it through examples, and then doing it themselves with critiques. That's how you teach, and it's simple. It's just like, you know, the way they used to teach in college. You went and had a lecture and a recitation. And in the recitation leader, some grad student probably, showed you face-to-face how this thing works or how to do that kind of math or whatever the problem would be. And so it's the same process. You give them learning, you give them examples, and then you give them practice.
In 2002, I was getting my MBA, and I tried to convince my classmates that we should do a project on what is now called neuromarketing. I wanted to hook electrodes up to my classmates' heads, measure their brainwaves while we basically told them stories or while they looked at advertisements, which are a form of visual storytelling, and just to see what their brains would do so we could kind of figure this out.
Yeah.
This has now become a much more of a science than it was a decade ago, and maybe 2-3 years ago. I sat next to the CMO of Monsanto at a neuromarketing conference at Stanford. And, okay, that kind of scared me a little bit. But is storytelling a form of manipulation? Is it fair for a company to be able to tell a really effective story? Are they taking advantage of their customers or their audience when they do that?
No. You can lie either way.
Okay, very fair point.
Have a choice, okay? You can put PowerPoint presentation up there and slant all the data in your favor, which is what we do when we make a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah, that's what PowerPoint's for, right?
At the bottom, at the end of the day, you want to persuade. And so you put up your data, your authorities, your pie charts, and whatnot. You put up your point, therefore, right? And you deliberately distort it. You ignore or avoid everything that would contradict what you're saying. That's one kind of persuasion. The wonderful thing about story is that in order to use story to persuade, to get the light to go on and people go, oh yeah, I get it, you have to show the negative side. In rhetoric, you do not show the anything that contradicts yourself. But in story, you're talking about reality, the dynamic of change, how things move from positive to negative, and you have to embrace both sides to tell a story, but it can be bullshit too. Story can distort, but the interesting thing is, though, most people know when they're being bullshitted. And so if you use story to bullshit, it won't work, because people have a kind of an antenna for the truth, and they know when it's distorted, when it's a lie. So you as I said, you can lie in rhetoric, you can lie in story. It's more difficult to lie in story, but let's say you can't. And in terms of fairness, no. I mean, there's nothing unfair about an honest communication saying, look, here's the situation. This is where this company has been. This is where the company is now. And here's our strategy in story form for the future. And if we follow this strategy, we will have success. If we go in that direction or that direction, we will fail. That is honest. That is as real as it is possible to get. Your projection for the future may not pan out, but you have a plan, and it's based in data. It's based in reality. And it's as, it's as truthful as anything ever gets in life. And so it's not a question of ethics. To lie is to lie. Ethically, it's immoral to do that. But you whichever way you do it, out of rhetoric or in story, it's a lie. And so and there's nothing wrong with rhetoric, by the way. I mean, if you can really make an excellent PowerPoint presentation that has solid fact that people don't argue with, and convince people that this is the logic of it, and therefore, right, why not? I mean, I'm not a fanatic for story. What I'm a fanatic for is excellent communication in business, and whatever communicates the truth is effective business technique. Whatever communicates lies is just going to come back and bite you in the ass.
And so that, whoever the, do
it. And so if you're honest and you're trying to persuade people to see things for what they really are, then there's no ethics. There's no question of ethics.
So the built-in integrity detector that we all have,
it is
part of that. Okay.
Sure.
It's
survival. If people in business lie to one another, deceive one another within the company's doomed.
Yes.
If they lie to their clients or to their customers, the market will destroy them.
Yep.
And today, more than ever, because today people communicate faster and wider than ever before, and things go viral. Success goes viral, and lies go viral, and they will rate you 1 to 5. I've said that storytelling, the ability to take data, storyfy it, and tell a story from the either the consumer's point of view, what you were talking about, Dave, for those years that you were working. You had a product-centric story, and your problem was to get empathy for that product.
Right.
Right? And so you had to personify that product in such a way that people didn't people understood the story is not directly about them, but by implication it's about them, and that they identified, or trying to get them to identify with the product itself. When you're the third possibility, of course, is what we call branding, and there you're trying to get the world to take a positive attitude toward a brand and try to get empathy for a brand, getting empathy for a corporation. Again, I can't think of harder work than that. Given the attitude. I read the other day that if 95% of all brands disappeared tomorrow, 95% of all people would not care. So getting the public to take an attitude toward brand. There's a metric company called Hamas that does what they call the Meaningful Brand Index. Mm-hmm. And the measurement is based upon the public's attitude. This brand enhances my life. This brand improves my life. And guess what is number one at the top of the Meaningful Brand Index?
Apple.
Nope.
Google.
It's up there. It's number three.
Okay. Not a bad guess, but I'm not sure it would be number one.
Google.
Oh, I did Google. That was my second choice. All right.
Yeah. That's number one. This brand improves my life. You know what was number two between Google and Apple? Samsung.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because this is an international. Right?
Power and numbers.
Outside of the United States, Samsung has as much or more presence in the world as Apple does.
Anyway,
the attitude is this brand improves my life, and therefore people identify with the brand and the feeling that this brand is on my side. This brand understands me. This brand is working to improve my life. And to do that, you need story. There's no other way. You can't just say we're the biggest, we're the best, we're the, whatever, and expect people to identify. And if companies don't get this, they're in real trouble. Because the millennial generation, people under the age of 35 or so today, they see bragging and promising coming a mile away, and they laugh at it.
Yeah.
They see emotional manipulation coming, and they laugh at it. They know when people are trying to use them. They know when people are bullshitting. And they find bragging and promising just ill-mannered.
Yeah.
Ill-mannered. And so if a company today wants to get that millennial market and hold it, over the decades in the future, as these people grow older, they have to stop this typical. I mean, we have been the essence of advertising for over 100 years has been bragging and promising, bragging and promising. That just does not work anymore. But advertising agencies and PR firms continue to brag, continue to promise, and then wonder why the brand's awareness is declining, wonder why sales aren't, increasing. And old people, like me, we're so used to bragging and promising. We don't sneer much. young people do. And they don't want to be interrupted. What they want is to be entertained. And a story is a little business story is a very brief. They usually only have one turning point, maybe two. And they're very brief. And the most precious asset that a company can have is the ability to get attention and to hold attention for whatever time it takes, 30 seconds, 3 minutes, whatever, to hook and hold attention and move people to act. But the first, you got to get their attention. And the way you get the attention is you tell a story that has a hooky opening, a turning point that hooks interest. And someone goes, really? Really? What happens next? And bragging does not get attention.
Right.
Just turn it off.
Now, if you were to stand up and if you were to market to an older audience, you might stand up and say something very much like, look at all the success. I've done really, really well, et cetera, whatever. If you were to take that and translate it to a story that would work for a younger audience, but you want to convey that same idea, how do you flip it? What do you do in order to basically?
How do you turn bragging into a story?
Assuming that the bragging is there, so
really well, I'm really really good at what I do.
I'll put it out there. I lost 100 pounds. Right, and I'm not bragging about it. I still have stretch marks. I was obese for much of my life. Right, the only reason I bring this up is that when I'm talking with people who are trying out the stuff that I do, the stuff that I wrote about in my New York Times bestselling book, it's illustrative of the point. But honestly, it's not. Hey, look at me. There's 10,000 guys who are more ripped with better abs than me. But it's like, look, this is an example of what you can do. How do you do that? Because I don't really brag about this. But there are people who are like, oh, Dave likes to talk about himself. No, I like to talk about how you can lose a ton of weight, and I just happen to be
why don't you just talk about how you can lose a ton of weight?
Cool.
Just shift your pronouns.
Okay, cool.
All right? It's not hard. It's just getting rid of the words I, me, mine, my,
Amen.
And change it to you.
Yes.
Right? You is both plural and singular. And so just shift the pronoun around. And one way to get it back to your success is to tell a story that stars you, whoever you're talking to, and reach a point where the person is. And then you say there's a way out. This is the technique, or this is the change that you have to make in your lifestyle. And I suffered this. When I made that change, okay, and so being able to validate that you have gone through what they're going through or will go through is important. But as soon as possible, get it back to them.
That makes sense. I just want to be the guinea pig there to say, look, it's possible because the work that I do is certainly about making change in other people. I'm pretty happy with where I am now, and that's I don't need to talk about myself.
It helps. I mean, when you mentioned your book just now, I'm sure out of habit, you said it was a New York Times bestseller. That's bragging.
Cool. Thanks for that. I'm always torn now because with ebooks,
New York Times bestseller, it just comes out, right?
Yeah. Thanks for that feedback.
But it's bragging. It depends on how face to face you are with the person you're talking to.
Right.
When you're literally face to face, you can see it in their eyes when there's doubt.
Okay.
Therefore, you can move the story that you're telling to satisfy that doubt by saying, I wrote a book on this, right? And X thousands of people used it, and I get, letters and emails telling me thanks, okay? So it will work. And let them assume that it was a bestseller given the numbers that you, whatever. But if you're telling a story as you do, broadcasting, then you can't see their faces, and you have to sense when their doubt might arise and find a way to move the story towards something that would satisfy that doubt. If you've done this long enough, you know how to have that sort of sixth sense that tells you, this is a point where I think I need to use a little rhetoric, introduce the facts, and to bolster this moment. And how much or how little of that, who can say? It really depends on so many factors that vary from story to story. But the beautiful thing about story is it allows you, if you come to a turning point, it allows you, you've got their curiosity, it allows you then to dump exposition in and to pour in the facts because they're hooked. They want to know how is this going to turn out. And at that point, then comes the data. And so the story incorporates data wonderfully. And so you've got facts to back up. But you want to put them in a context at a moment when they're really hooked and they really want to know. In what you were saying at the very beginning in your introduction, that there's a neurology to this, there's a neuroscience behind this, and that when you tell story really well, there comes a moment in the listener, in the audience, where their mind is absolutely open and receptive. At that point, you put in the brand. In that point, you put in the last step, the one you want them to take to look into the service or the product. And you can't get that in rhetoric. Rhetoric is arm twisting of a certain kind, but story just opens people up and makes them receptive when it's well done, of course. All of this is predicated on skill and a really well-told story.
One of the things that Bulletproof Radio focuses on is understanding how people get to the top of their game. And Peter Jackson called you the guru of gurus. And you're one of the top storytellers out there. And where I've probably been deficient in asking questions today, because I just actually got a chance to be schooled by a guru. But how did you get to be so good at this? Like, what did you do to be at this level?
I told the truth. That's the real difference. First of all, I have real knowledge. The lectures that I give are based on decades and decades of experience directing in the theater. I directed professionally over 60 plays. I acted professionally in 60 plays. And therefore, my job was to unravel what writers had done and then recreate it in a performance or in a cast of characters on stage. I followed that with 3 years of research and a bibliography that was literally 300 titles long into the art of story for stage, page, and screen. And then I was a writer. And I had a good deal of success writing television. I sold 20 screenplay deals in Hollywood, so I was a successful writer. So I had knowledge. I noticed that what other people were doing in trying to teach writing was pretending that it's easy and that there's a formula. And step by step, you follow this recipe and voila, a wonderful screenplay, and you'll have your name on the screen and make $1 million. And essentially, they were lying to people. They were pretending it was easy and that anybody could do it. What I did and do is tell the truth. This is really difficult. You're probably in over your head. And if you're going to succeed, you're going to have to dedicate the next 10 years of your life and 10 years of failure and 10 screenplays that nobody wants, plays that never see a stage, books that nobody publishes. It's going to take you 10 major works of story art to fail again and again and again in order to master this very difficult art form. And I lectured to drive the dilettantes out of the room. I only lectured to dedicated professionals. And I don't mean people who make money writing. I mean professional in their attitude. They have high standards. They're not just trying to copy last year's summer hits or whatever. They want to write original, insightful, meaningful, emotional storytelling for stage, page, or screen. And I take a tough attitude toward it, and I make people work really hard in the lecture. They take 100 pages, 200 pages of notes. The result is my reputation grew. Word of mouth spread around the world that this guy will sit you down and will not bullshit you, and you will learn what story is, and you will have some insight into content as well as form. I think that's the reason I'm a success. I really do. I hear whispers about, I've never been to anybody else's lecture, but I hear, you know, whispers about what goes on, and the ass kissing is notorious in these things. And I just won't do that. I'm not rude. I try not to be rude, but I don't kiss their ass. I don't hold their hands. Writing is the loneliest job in the world. You got to sit in your pit with your characters in your head, and there's nobody there to help you. You have to do it on your own. And, you know, seeking support and what is just another form of procrastination. You have to do it on your own. And so I don't want people coming to my lecture thinking that I'll be there for them. I'm not going to be there for them. They're going to do it on their own. And when they, you know, and when people reject their first efforts, I mean, the first thing you write is always the worst thing you'll ever write. I mean, any common sense tells you. And when it's rejected, you know, you're going to have to pull yourself back up and start the next project. I mean, writers aren't people with a story to tell. Writers are people with stories to tell their whole life. And so they start the next one and the next one and the next one, and they're going to do it on their own. So if they can't deal with the truth in my lecture, they're never going to deal with it on their own. At their keyboard. I'm tough and practical and real and I don't bullshit. But it's a lot of fun. The lecture is also very funny. I mean, I used to do stand up comedy, and I use a lot of shtick in what I do. As a result, word of mouth spread around the world for the last 25, 30 years that you'll learn from this guy. It is what it is. I never made any effort to market it. I got it, and the phone would ring. People would call. I'd get invitations to come to this part of the world, that part of the world. It just happened purely by word of mouth.
Well, I can tell you, during the course of this interview, you've convinced me that I need to come to one of your lectures. So I'll definitely be doing that, probably in LA somewhere.
Yeah, you'll get an invitation, Dave. Don't worry.
Oh, beautiful. I appreciate it. And there's a question that every guest on Bulletproof Radio answers at the end of the show. And it's based on all the stuff you know, not just about storytelling, but just your entire life's path. If someone came to you and said, look, I want to perform better at everything, what are the three most important things that they need to know, or three things they need to do? Like just the most important piece of advice you have for someone, the top three.
Well, persistence. It takes practice to perfect something. And so you can't give up. You have to persist. And some people are capable of persistence and others not. And people just generally wait for a crisis and then they get serious, and how long they can stick to it, who can say? But persistence, number one. Number two is a high standard. If you want to do something well, you've got to want to do it as well as the very best people who do this thing do it. You won't necessarily get to that level. You know, that's a rarefied stratus for the most talented and the most whatever. But in the constant pursuit of perfection, you will achieve the best. People who achieve are not willing to settle for good enough. And so they have to have high standards, they have to be persistent, and they have to understand that excellence of any kind, whether it's a sport, whether it's a business thing, whatever, that excellence of any kind is based upon knowledge. They have to do research, they have to know what it is they're trying to do. And the more they can understand what they're trying to do, the better they'll be at it. The notion that you can rely on your instincts is really foolishness.
Robert, thanks for that incredible knowledge. I really appreciate being able to learn from someone at your level. Where can people find out more about Storynomics and about what you do, the just your overall body of work?
They go to our website, which is mckeestory.com.
That's McKee story.com.
That's it. McKeeStory.com. And it'll all be there for them.
Okay. And we'll put that link in the show notes so people can come on over and download the transcript or anything else in order to find your work. I really appreciate you taking the time on Bulletproof Radio today, because it's an honor to be able to talk to people who spent their whole career focusing on one skill and helped some of the very top people in the world. So I consider it really an amazing opportunity to get a chance to chat with you. And I enjoyed myself.
And I enjoyed it too. Those were good questions. And it was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem, or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.